I would like to introduce to you Professor Christopher Malikani of the University of Witwatersrand, who will discuss the role of savings in our country and how this grows an economy. It's clear from what Peter has just described that growth is an absolute necessity. Professor Malikani received his PhD from the New School for Social Research in New York in 2007 and his master's degree from Fordham University through the Fulbright Scholarship Program. Among the awards he received are the Edith Henry Johnson Memorial Award for Outstanding PhD Dissertation in Economics, New School for Social Research, New York, 2007. His current areas of interest are in monetary policy, business cycles, political economy, and financial economics. He has published in international journals and in book chapters. Among his recent published articles are A Behavioral Macroeconomic Model of Exchange Rate Fluctuations with Complex Market Expectations Formation, Computational Economics, The New Keynesian Phillips Curve, Endogeneity and Misspecification, Applied Economics, Price and Liquidity Puzzles of a Monetary Stock, Evidence from Indebted African Countries, as well as Economic Modeling. He is the director of the Macroeconomics and Financial Analyst Group at a research unit in the School of Economic and Business Sciences at WITS, and he teaches the following courses: Economics at Principles Level, Advanced Macroeconomics, as well as Portfolio Theory. Professor Malikani was a member of the first National Planning Commission between 2010 and 2012, as well as the Gauteng Planning Commission between 2010 and 2012. He was also economics political advisor to COSATU between 2009 and 2012, as well as a member of the advisory panel for the Minister of Economic Development. Professor Malikani reviews international evidence on the determinants of savings behavior with a focus on evidence from developing countries. The aim of his presentation is to draw lessons for South Africa. He will cover the motives for private savings and the role of savings in an economy in general. He will provide a summary of theories of savings behavior. I do warn you, there are numerous formulae in this section. He will also provide empirical evidence on the determinants of savings rates. We will also critically discuss the empirical results from studies that focus on South Africa and conclude with some policy recommendations based on his analysis of international evidence and the South African situation. Professor Malikani, thank you.
Thanks, Costa, for a nice introduction. Thank you, colleagues, for giving me this opportunity. The work that I will be presenting to you is work that was basically initially funded by the MMI Holdings, because they wanted to understand what the academic literature says are the determinants of savings, private households and corporate across the world, and to begin to learn how these factors that drive savings impact on the South African economy. So the starting point was for us to basically do a survey of what the literature says are the is the role of savings in an economy. And there's a general view that savings are a source of funds for capital accumulation and long-run economic growth. And this idea can be found in the classical writers like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Karl Marx. Basically, these authors, particularly Marx, Marx's theory of economic growth says that the savings rate of an economy is basically the product of the savings rates of entrepreneurs times the rate of profit. So if you want to get a rough idea of what the savings rate to be should be of entrepreneurs, just get the average rate of profit of the South African economy, and on the left-hand side you'll have your growth rate, and then you can divide by the rate of profit to get roughly what the savings rate is supposed to be in order to deliver the growth rate that you desire. And subsequent authors, of course, have put savings, particularly the savings rate, as a determinant of growth. In 1986, an economist by the name of Roma reintroduced the savings rate as a factor that drives economic growth. Before then, between 1867, i.e. between Marx and Roma, they developed other theories as well. Keynes and theories, but a theory that became very, very influential was what we call the neoclassical growth theory. And interestingly, that theory basically says that the savings rate has no impact on the long-run growth rate of the economy. And the growth rate of the economy is determined by the growth rate of the labor force and the rate of technical progress. There's no role for savings. And it was a big gap in the literature because it is well known that savings rates do influence the growth rate. And it was in 1986 that modification was made by Roma. Savings are also important for consumption smoothing from the household side and the provision of bequests, passing wealth from one generation to the other is what savings do. And Keynes, if you look at Keynes's book, it goes into detail on the motives for saving by both households and corporates. And those are some of the reasons: the motive for enterprise, the need for liquidity improvement, financial prudence, and so forth. People, when they see firms that have got surpluses, they tend to think that those firms are well run, and so they can cushion investors against adverse shocks that may hit those firms. Even households themselves, when they do consumption smoothing through savings, they basically want to cushion themselves against adverse shocks. So then we went through various theories of savings, and those are some of the theories. There are theories that are based on the macro balance, macroeconomic balance, which is what Peter was talking about when someone asked the question, why is investment above savings in South Africa? And then Peter said that it's because of the import of capital through the current account. The first equation there explains precisely that point, where we say that the savings rate, that is the private savings rate in the economy, must be equal to the investment rate, where Y is basically GDP. And then the second part the second part of the equation is the government is saving. So if government is running deficits, government will have to finance those deficits, and they will have to be taken from savings, private savings, and also deficits on the current account. So if we run deficits on the current account, we need to finance those deficits, and savings then go to financing those deficits. And net capital flows. Of course, those ones, that's what Peter was talking about when he says importation of capital to fill in the savings gap between investment and national savings. So what is this thing saying? This thing is saying that basically if government is running surpluses, that will tend to increase national savings, provided that those surpluses are not one-to-one. But as the equation stands there, if government runs deficits, it will mean that the private sector will have little resources to finance their investment, because part of the savings will be used to finance the government deficit, and little will be left for private sector investment. That's what that equation says. And the second part, of course, is Keynes' theory, which says that the savings rate is determined by the level of income, as you can see there. If Y increases over time, that will tend to increase savings. Then the third theory is a theory by Caldo. Peter mentioned something about income distribution. He said that if we redistribute income to the poor will take that income and consume it because they've got low levels of income to begin with. So Caldo's theory basically is the first theory to put income distribution in the savings equation. That U there is a worker's share in national income. So that 1 minus U is what Caldo calls the capitalist share in national income. So if you shift income from capitalists to workers, the impact is that you are likely to have a lower savings rate, because in Caldo's theory, workers are the poor and the capitalists are the rich. So the income redistribution to the poor is likely to lower savings. So that is a big thing that we need to be aware of. And then there are other theories. I can say that in the literature, the dominant theory that is used to test or to find what determines savings is the life cycle hypothesis of Modigliani and Bloomberg. That first equation basically says that the savings rate in the economy is determined by the growth rate in a positive way. The higher the growth rate, the higher will be the savings rate. And the second portion, that omega there, is wealth. The higher the wealth, household wealth, for example, or private sector wealth, the lower will be the savings rate. The idea there is that if wealth is high, i.e. net wealth is high, then credit constraints are loose, and then people can have access to credit to consume, and that will tend to lower the savings rate. And as to the real interest rate, the literature finds that the real interest rate has got ambiguous effects. For an example, others argue that the higher the interest rate, that will encourage people to save more. But others argue that if interest rates are expected to be high, that will tend to lower the expected inflows from expected cash flows from assets, and that will lower the incentive for people to save to accumulate those assets. So it depends on whether you view interest rate as expected interest rate or current interest rate. So, but in the literature, empirically, they find that the impact of the real interest rate is actually ambiguous on the savings rate. And lastly, the big factor across the board that we found is the dependency ratio, which is the ratio of the people who are below the working age plus those that are above the working age, the people who've retired. So the number of people who've retired and the people who are less than 15 years of age divided by the population. That's what is called a dependency ratio. That has a negative impact on savings because children consume and old people, they consume as well. So that's the idea. And then the other theories, of course, Friedman, permanent income hypothesis, and the Hall's random walk. Those ones, they are not used empirically to determine the drivers of savings, although some empirical models do specify them. It is the life cycle hypothesis, really, which is the workhorse that is used across many countries to test. Now, in terms of the macro balance evidence, it is found that public saving partially offsets private saving, i.e., if the government is running surpluses, those surpluses partially offset, i.e., they tend to partially reduce private saving. And because of that, it means that if you increase public saving, i.e., government run surpluses, overall national savings would increase. That's what that evidence says. And another one is this: current account deficits tend to lower private savings. So if a country tends to run current account deficits, remember, we'll need those savings to finance this current account deficit. So it tends to then lower private savings. This is very important, particularly if you think of a country that is not industrializing or a country whose manufacturing sector is shrinking. That country will tend to import high value-added products and export low value-added products. So it will tend to run current account deficits, and it will tend, therefore, to have a low savings rate. The growth rate drives the savings rate, and also GDP per capita drives private savings as well. Inflation and interest rates, these ones have got ambiguous effects. That's what we find in the literature. And if they do have, like, for example, interest rates, if they do have positive impact, the results show that those effects are very weak and they are not robust. If you change samples, you find that it's significant over one sample, in another sample it's not significant. You change another sample, it changes the sign, it becomes negative as well. So generally, the literature reveals that the macroeconomic variables like interest rates, inflation rates, they tend to have ambiguous effects on private savings. Terms of trade. Adverse terms of trade tend to reduce savings. Basically, what are the terms of trade? It's the price of what you export divided by the price of what you import. So think about developing countries, for example. They tend to export low value-added products, raw minerals and so forth, and import high value-added products like manufactured equipment and so forth. So if the price of commodities drops, it means that you've got adverse terms of trade, and that tends to lower your savings rate as a country. And that goes back to the current account, and it worsens your current account as well. Demographics, dependency across all the studies that we've looked at lowers private savings. And urbanization as well tends to lower private savings. And the reason for urbanization to lower private savings is because of the costs of the cost of living in urban areas tends to be relatively high compared to rural areas, so that lowers savings as well. Access to credit, as the life cycle hypothesis said, if you have access to credit, that will tend to lower savings. So what we find here is that credit constraints raise private savings, i.e. if you have stringent access to credit to households and even private individuals, that tends to raise the savings rate because they don't have access to credit to consume. Financial development is another variable that tends to raise the savings rate. Financial development is about development of capital markets, financial markets and so forth. And this is very important for particularly the African continent, where capital markets still have to be developed. People need financial instruments through which they can save. And if those financial instruments are not there, then the instruments through which people can save are very limited, and that tends to discourage savings. Wealth lowers savings because there's collateral for credit, and people can use that to access credit, and then they consume beyond their immediate income. Another factor that was surprising from the literature is financial liberalization. So, for example, when the state in the past, in the 80s, 70s, governments used to regulate interest rates, keep interest rates low, right? So in the 80s, there was a move to liberalize, basically to allow interest rates to be determined by market forces. And the impact of that was that it tended to lower savings. That's what happened. And actually, as you see, a study in South Africa that was done by some authors for the World Bank showed that actually private savings in South Africa declined as a result of financial liberalization. Social security, the structure and financing of social security is important. But the literature finds that the structure of social security is ambiguous, has an ambiguous impact. But the financing of social security has a definite impact. For an example, as Peter was mentioning, if you raise taxes for the high-income earners in order to finance social security for the low-income earners, that will tend to lower the savings rate because you are taxing the ones that are saving more to finance the ones that are saving less. So if you shift income through social security from the high-income earners to low-income earners, that will tend to lower the savings rate. This evidence is particularly widespread in Latin America. South Africa, as I mentioned before, that study by Aaron and Mel Bauer, 2000, from the World Bank Economic Review, found that financial liberalization actually lowers the private savings rate in South Africa. And what they found is that the corporate savings in South Africa rose after financial liberalization, but household savings declined. And in fact, this decline that Peter was mentioning is not just a recent phenomenon. This decline started in the early 1980s. Household savings started declining in the early 1980s, and it has not recovered ever since. It's on a downward trend. Real interest, the growth rate drives private savings. That is the study by Odhiambo, fairly recent, 2007. Real interest rate are ambiguous, have an ambiguous impact on private savings. Other authors find a positive impact, and others find a negative impact. So there's no robust relationship between interest rates and the savings rate. Household savings are partially offset by public savings, which means that if government runs surpluses, it will tend to raise national savings because it partially offsets private savings, not a one-to-one relationship. However, the big weakness with South African studies is that they don't look at the demographic factors like dependency, urbanization, as well as the structure and the financing of social security. Those variables have not been included in the studies. So briefly, what are the drivers of savings? Right. Number one, demographics matter. Right. We need to find a way to plan population growth and to forecast population growth. And we need to manage urbanization through the provision of affordable public infrastructure. I think that will go a long way in releasing funds for urban households for savings. We know that most of the households, they spend at least a third of their income on public transport. So there's very little really that they can save. But the provision of public transport that is affordable and efficient cannot just raise their savings rate, but also improve their productivity in the economy. The growth rate drives savings. The classical view is that the savings rate drives the growth rate. It is correct in the long run. However, what has been found, here is, there's a paper by Roderick, which we reference in the bigger paper upon which these slides are based. It shows that the fast-growing Southeast Asian economies, they managed fundamentally to raise their savings rate by having a proper growth strategy. So if you have faster economic growth, you are like, that is the most powerful factor to drive your savings rate. And that is the work by Daniel Roderick. And how did they do it? They did that by raising entrepreneurial profit rates. So if the profit rates of entrepreneurs are high, the incentive to invest will be high. And hence, the growth rate of the economy will tend to be high. And that will spill over into rising incomes and higher savings. And the implication here is clearly that perhaps we need to look at our growth strategy as a country in order to raise our savings rate and not the other way around, and try to make people to save more in the context where the growth rate is going down. So maybe we need to think of this in the reverse. Inflation and real interest rates have ambiguous impacts, and so I would really say that to base policies, interest rate, like savings policies on these variables will be very risky because internationally they've got ambiguous impacts on savings. Fiscal surpluses raise national savings. However, we need to be careful on how we raise these fiscal surpluses. They cannot be raised on the basis of simply cutting government spending, because if you just cut government spending, that will reduce aggregate demand in the economy and can have an adverse impact on the private sector. So what needs to happen, in my view, I think there needs to be improvements on the efficiency of public spending. And improvements, of course, on the impact, the structure of the spending. Where do we spend on? Right, and the Minister of Finance has consistently raised concerns that the spending is more on the consumption side of government spending. It's not on the investment side. So if government spending is redirected towards more infrastructure spending and the efficiency, cut down the corruption and so forth, then that can improve our savings rate. The structure and financing of social security matters. As we mentioned before, if you tax the rich or tax the high-income earners to finance social security for the low-income earners, that can have perverse impacts on savings. So perhaps what we need to be talking about is maybe we need some mandatory savings for everyone who works. There's nothing that stops, I think, even those that are earning 1,000 rands a month to put aside something like 20 rands as a means of beginning to inculcate that culture of saving. But to say that people, they don't have to save, they can consume all their income, or they can just take all their income without any some mandatory requirement might be a problem. So people must be encouraged to save no matter how small their levels of income are. And this is the method or the policy that has been adopted in Singapore. There's a certain proportion of income that everybody who's working is saving, and that proportion of income is then transferred to a national savings fund. Structural current account deficits lower the savings rate. We've been running current account deficits for a long period of time. If there are surpluses, it has been for a small period of time. But if you look at the South African data on the current account deficit, it's just deficits for years and years. So there needs to be a way of addressing that. And one issue that we need to raise is the issue of industrial policy, as we mentioned. If you look at our manufacturing sector in South Africa, it has been declining as a proportion of GDP. Since 1994, it declined from about 20% of GDP to now less than 11% of GDP. So our capacity as a country to add value to our exports is shrinking year after year. It's structured the way, when you look at the trends, it looks like the savings rates, the household savings rates. So there is a need to industrialize and not to de-industrialize. And then there's this issue of foreign ownership. No country that we've looked at in the literature have raised their savings rate with excessive foreign ownership of its big industries. Because if you have excessive foreign ownership of big industries, that's where you've got your profits, and your profits then get exported, and your capacity, the resource for you to save, gets limited. We ask ourselves a question: how did the South Koreans engage in faster growth or experience faster growth? They experienced faster growth on the basis, firstly, of suppressing the wage and using the surplus that they generated to reinvest and reinvest and build industries and reinvest. There was minimal export of profits in those economies. And that is a big issue that we as South Africans need to look at. We need to look at our national accounts. If you look at our national accounts, you see the degree of profit outflows as a result of massive foreign ownership. And another issue, of course, tied to that is that if we don't have control over our natural resources, right, it means that we cannot direct our natural resources to local industries to industrialize and add value so that we export high-value added products. So if we keep on having our natural resources being controlled by big foreign-owned companies and firms, the impact of that is that those natural resources are going elsewhere to build industries elsewhere and increase and maintain high savings rates elsewhere. So these are the big issues that we need to talk about. Institutional reforms. Some countries have got sovereign wealth funds. Countries like Chile, Nigeria, Botswana, they've got sovereign wealth funds. Right? If you look at those countries are rich in mineral resources. Chile's fund was based on their copper resources, copper exports. Nigeria is based on oil. Botswana is based on diamonds. South Africa has no sovereign wealth fund. Yet, this country has 90% of the world's platinum. We've got 75% of the world's chromium. And we've got 80% of the world's manganese. We can go on and on and on. This country is rich in natural resources. Yet, we don't have a sovereign wealth fund through which we can save as a nation. And why is that the case? It's because these mineral resources are not controlled by South Africans. Unemployment raises the dependency ratio. So high unemployment rates, Peter mentioned this, it's a big factor. I mean, if you look at the general household survey, it says that 77% of the unemployed rely on the income of the employed to survive. 77% of the unemployed. So unemployment rate on its own is a constraint on savings. If people are not employed, they've got no income to save. So those are the few points that I would like to make on the determinants of savings. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Professor. I'll open the floor for some questions. We have about 15 minutes or so before tea time, and I encourage you to raise questions for the Professor's attention. Okay, we have a question in the back there.
Thank you. My question is based on the last issue which you touched, control of natural resources. I think that is a big issue today by foreign capitals. But the big question is, if we keep control of the natural resources, and we know very well that we've got a problem with shortage of skills to refine or to work on those minerals or whatever we do to give us the income we need, what would be the best resource? Because I think skills, you have the infrastructure in South Africa, but the skills is one of the biggest problems that is causing all these things we have discussed.
This question is very, very important, and I think we need to look at it critically. If you look at management of, let's say, the mining companies, you'll find that actually it's South Africans who are managing, the engineers in those mines, right, the workers and so forth. So South Africa does have the skills to run those enterprises. The issue is the benefits. Once the mineral is out, who benefits from that? So let's look at the mines, for example. Even the banks, it is South Africans who are actually running the bulk of the bank's operations. So in my view, I think the skills issue is being exaggerated. Skills shortage is being exaggerated. We do have capacity as South Africans, not as government. As South Africans, there is the skill that is there, that is currently running these companies. The issue is the benefits of this. It's a painful situation because I remember there was an accident in Carletonville. There was a mine that collapsed. It is South Africans, without foreign aid, it is South Africans who managed to rescue the miners underground with their own technology. So this country does have the skills. It's just that we are not in firm control, in control of our natural resources. This does not mean that, does not say that the broader South African population does have skills. No, we still have to work hard in improving our education system. But given the skills that we have, we are capable as South Africans to run these companies. We've been running them anyway. I mean, we ran Sasol. ISCO in 1987, if you look at the stats, ISCO in 1987 was number 7 in the world in terms of steel production. Number 7, this country, was ranking high in the world. It was South Africans who were running those companies. There is a skill. It's just that we need to harness it, direct it, and make sure that what it produces benefits the country as a whole.
Yeah, hi. I've just got a few questions regarding idea of savings in the international perspective. Firstly, I was wondering if the studies were involved looking at the cultural elements of savings. If you look at the Germans versus the Americans, how they view differently the idea of savings. Also the idea of how women view savings differently to men. And then you've got all these IT people who like to save and control those savings and have total control versus those people who like to sit back and not be involved in the savings process at all. And that gives you the question of compulsory versus voluntary savings, if that has been taken into account. And then last and least is, does the idea of compound interest really actually work if somebody suddenly, particularly in an African context, earns nothing for a long, 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 long period, and then at the end, the last couple of years, has ginormous salaries at the end before he gets to retirement. Is that also taken into account in the studies? And those are the kind of questions maybe one needs to ask in terms of savings patterns.
Did you hear that? Could you just repeat that? It was just not very clear at the back. Your question wasn't very clear.
Which question?
So the first part of your question was to confirm. Is to talk about international experience on savings, the Germans versus the US, for example.
Yeah, like the different attitude towards savings, for example, the German attitude versus the American attitude towards savings, and then the different attitude towards savings of men versus women. There's a definite different lookout of savings. And then looking at those people who are techni-savvy, who like to control their savings and how they do the savings. And that brings into question of whether if you bring in more compulsory savings elements into a question, whether there might be a deterrent into actually creating more of a savings environment. And then the idea of this concept of building a savings element that just of compound interest, not in taking into account the people having massive incomes at the end of their working career rather than having tiny incomes in the beginning of their working career.
Yeah. So most of the studies that we reviewed are not micro-level studies. For example, they are not looking at savings behavior of men and women, but they are more macro-level studies, looking at household savings in the aggregate and national savings in the aggregate or even corporate savings in the aggregate. So they are not micro-level studies. Even the question of what the studies say about attitudes to savings, so the studies that we looked at did not say anything about that because they are not micro-level studies to savings. Now, in terms of the African context and savings, I think one of the big constraints that we need to look at in the African context is the development of financial markets, capital markets. Because if you look at many countries, financial markets are not that developed. You find that countries do not even have long-term government bonds through which they can mobilize savings. Most of the instruments that are there, they are short-term treasury bills that are used to finance short-term government financing needs. But most of the countries really rely on foreign aid to finance their deficits. So there is a need for a drive to develop financial markets and financial institutions in the African context. And also, I think one of the things that is missing, particularly in South Africa, when it comes to changing the savings culture, is the lack of proper education or the channeling of education to the workers. I've been advisor to COSATU for about 4 or 5 years. I worked with trade unions during that period of time. Those unions, they can serve as powerful conduits through which education can be filtered down to workers. But there have not been workshops, really, systematic workshops that have been driven by trade unions to encourage savings amongst members. And we know one of the things around the Marikana issue was the role of loan sharks, workers being vulnerable to loan sharks, over-indebtedness of working-class households. That has to do with education, but trade unions in this instance, I think, can be used as powerful institutions through which they can filter down the education to members and increase the savings culture.
Professor, have you seen any studies or did you come across or look for in your own studies a dissection of where savings are going? So I would imagine saving on your mattress or even saving in gold has a very different impact on the economy to saving in a long-term policy that can be invested productively. I've been trying to look for statistics on South Africa lately, and it's been frustrating trying to find where this savings is going, both in terms of where it's going in and where it's coming out, because people are saving. If our net savings rate is round about zero, where's it going in and where's it coming out of, you know?
Yeah. I think the best approach to check where the savings are going is to use the macroeconomic balance. We need to look at those sectors of the economy that are running deficits. Which are those sectors that are running deficits? Because savings are arising from sectors that are running surpluses to finance deficit sectors. So if you look at South Africa, for example, if we are running structurally current account deficits, it means that we need to finance those deficits somehow. That absorbs deficits, savings. Look at government. If government is running deficits, government absorbs those savings. And then what remains really is what South Africans can finance in terms to undertake investment. If it's not sufficient, then you have to import capital through net capital inflows. So we need to look at which sectors. Is it government that is running deficits? If government is running deficits, it means that government is absorbing the savings. If we're running deficits on the current account, it means that that current account deficit is absorbing our savings. And then we need to look at then what then remains. If what remains is less than what we are investing, it means that we're now importing foreign savings to finance the investment gap. And I think that's where South Africa is. And as we run these deficits, it means that we are increasing public debt. If government is running public deficits, it means that public debt is rising. If we're running persistent current account deficits, it means that our foreign debt is persistently rising. It's no wonder that sooner or later we'll have to be downgraded if we have persistent rising debt. Like Peter was showing us, you see that the debts are rising and then they are plateauing, but they're still rising. So as long as we are still having that rising debt, it's not stabilizing, then it means that we are still running deficits that need savings to be financed, and that is the accumulation of debt. If you look at the financial sector, for example, how do they fund the distribution of their funds, their loans? Interestingly, most of their loans are not going to the manufacturing sector or to the productive sectors of the economy. Most of their loans, they are going to the real estate sector. Some of their money that is in the financial system is going to financial speculation, trading, and so forth. It's not going to the productive sectors like agriculture, mining, manufacturing, and so forth. And if you look at there's a study that we did, but this one is for the rest of the African continent. We looked at where foreign direct investment is going, which is foreign savings in the African continent. It's going to the resource industries, like the mineral oil industry. It's not going to the manufacturing sectors where you can get high value added. So where savings are going are channeled also tends to reinforce the structure of the economy, which is detrimental to long-term economic growth and savings.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Professor, on behalf of the RMC of the Actuarial Society of South Africa and the audience that is before you today, I'd like to thank you for the effort that you've made in putting the presentation together and to also give up your very valuable time to come and present to us today and give us a sense as to what it is that encourages savings. Thank you very much. Right, we've had a very good setting in terms of the economy, the political landscape, where we're heading, where we're not heading. We've been given a sense from the professor as to what it is that encourages savings, what are the key drivers of those savings rates. I'm now going to ask that you go out and spend half an hour having a leg stretch, a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, and then to come back at about 11:15 for you to listen to the experts as to how one actually goes about saving, how one, you know, the products that are needed to basically ensure the right levels of savings are being made, to the extent that you don't have savings, what is it that you can do to sustain your income needs. We have a number of exciting presentations still to come. So thanks very much for your time this morning. Look forward to seeing you here at 11:15. Thank you.